You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today, the big conversation, is sports amid the coronavirus pandemic. From elementary and high school to college and the pros, every level of the sporting world is still trying to navigate the pandemic. Major League Baseball and the NBA are back up and running, I guess you could say, though the Kings aren't doing so well in the Orlando bubble. More on that in just a moment. Soccer in the U.S. and across the globe was really one of the first sports to get things going amid COVID-19. Sac Republic FC has continued with their season. We'll hear from the team president in just a bit. And in California, high school sports are still king, but most fall sports, including football, likely won't start until December or January after the California Interscholastic Federation, you may know it as the CIF, put the brakes on in the fall season just last month. Will DeBoard is the assistant commissioner of the CIF San Joaquin section, and he joins us now. Welcome, Will.
Hey, Randall, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. And let's begin with what the CIF San Joaquin section is. Can you explain for those who may not be familiar with it?
Sure, no problem. The CIF overall is the governing body for high school sports in California. And the SAC Joaquin section is one of 10 sections within California that we have a little bit of our own rules. We do follow all the state rules, but our region runs from basically Yuba City to Merced. It's about 200 high schools. There are four of us here in staff, and our main responsibilities are running the playoffs, which we won't be doing anytime soon.
No, yeah.
Transfer eligibility, enforcing the rules. Also, we're, you know, like everybody else, certainly in the school world, we're raring to get back to it, but it's
yeah.
going to be a little bit, I think.
Well, that's a big chunk of the state. It's a big chunk of our listening area, for that matter, and some really good high schools in there. Okay, about 2 weeks ago, the CIF announced that there will be no high school sports in the fall. Can you explain how you guys came to that decision?
Sure. The 10 section commissioners, as well as the state office, the state office is kind of the equivalent of our federal government, and we're each our own state government, I guess.
Yeah.
And they have been meeting for months. It's been 3-4 months actually since all this really kind of ended our spring sports. And we kind of thought at the time, okay, we're going to have a month off, maybe a month and a half, and things kind of stayed the same, and all of a sudden fall sports became an issue. What's going to happen in the fall, and what's going to happen really in winter and spring?
What are you mainly looking to, like testing numbers?
Exactly. What are our schools doing? Most of our schools have been shutting down. They shut down as of March and really haven't got back. When you're not in school, you're really not going to be playing sports. Drops pretty low on the priority list. That's mm-hmm. for sure. You want to get kids back in. And the section commissioners have been meeting for months really to figure out when is a realistic time that we think we can go back and can actually have seasons. And honestly, until even a few weeks before July 20th, we, the San Joaquin section, were kind of hopeful that we were going to get something in as of October. And then it seems like the COVID cases increase exponentially. Our counties, most of our counties, the San Joaquin section covers 15 different counties. Most of those counties have been placed on the watch list, meaning distance learning for schools. And it really, at that point, it became unrealistic. So mm-hmm. we went to a January to June season.
And this is with fingers crossed?
Fingers crossed, exactly.
Yeah.
This is a calendar of hope is really what it is. It's hopeful optimism, that's for sure, that we can get that we can start practicing kind of mid-December and get rolling. And if it doesn't happen, we'll push back a little bit. And if it still doesn't happen and we're looking into February, March, we probably are going to have to make the difficult decision to not do fall sports and look toward winter and spring. But
are there certain sports, Will, that might be better for this pandemic situation where players are not in such close contact with each other that could maybe resume while others
can't?
Yeah,
I think golf and tennis are certainly the two at the front of the list. The people are playing golf now, and we don't appear to have people getting sick because they're out there playing golf or anything like that. Same with tennis, track and field, cross country, swimming, even
right.
These are all individual sports where there isn't a lot of contact. Those things that are realistic, they're realistically able to happen. Football and wrestling. on the other side of the spectrum there.
Right, yeah.
Definitely on the other side.
Hey, finally, Will, as we know, the players get a lot out of this, and so do the spectators, you know, coming together as a school community to cheer on your team, you know, can really bring together groups that don't normally intermix, perhaps. You're quoted in one article as saying that there are lessons learned on the field of play that are tough to learn in the classroom. Can you just briefly elaborate on that?
Sure. You're in the classroom, and you definitely learn. I call it being book smart. And when you're out there in the field of play, you learn about leadership. You learn humility, for sure. Anybody who's ever been a wrestler, at some point, you are going to learn all about humility when you have somebody's armpit in your face for 3 minutes before you get pinned, and in front of your closer friends. And I think it's just a matter of sometimes you don't win every single time, and you learn. This is really where you kind of learn to take a loss, and listening to your coaches. There's a little bit of everything out there. I think sports certainly teach a lot of lessons, and we see it in statistics and data that kids who play sports, they have higher GPAs, they're more involved in school, obviously.
Yeah, pride in the community.
Absolutely, absolutely. Uh-huh.
Cheering on, you know, Folsom or whatever it might be that you see.
For sure.
You know, moving forward in these rankings. Will DeBoard, Assistant Commissioner of the CIF SAC Joaquin Section, thank you so much for making time this morning to help sort of walk us through where all that stands. So I guess we're just all crossing fingers at this point.
Exactly. We're definitely all crossing fingers and hoping things look a little better in the next few months.
All right, Will. Thank you. SAC Republic FC has continued with their season. The team actually postponed their game last week on Wednesday against Orange County SC due to coronavirus tests from a previous opponent. Here with more on the team and how it's managing with COVID-19 is President and COO of SAC Republic FC, Ben Gumpert. Ben, thank you for making time.
Thank you for having me, Randall. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. So how has Sacramento Republic FC been impacted by the pandemic to this point, like the season and everything? Give us sort of an overview.
Yeah, directly from a season standpoint, we actually had just had our season opener. This dates back to March 7th, a home opener and a glorious one at that. It was our first regular season game since our MLS announcement back in October of last year. There was a lot of energy. We have a new head coach, new coaching staff, some new players, some of our famed players that have played with us in the past. So a lot of excitement and momentum going into the season, and a tremendous opening night, sellout crowd. 4 days later, the league, was officially on hiatus and postponed. And so a lot has changed. A lot has transpired. I'm sure we'll talk about just how we shifted both from our players, our entire staff, to a lot of community focused work that still continues. But about a little more than 4 months after that first night, we played our second match. And that was different, weird, unique. But we are now a few games back into our restart. It's a shortened season. It's a season that looks different, that feels different. But it's still a season, and so we're excited to have that going, and just came off a draw this past Saturday and have another game this next Saturday as well.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about soccer that allows for this level of play while reducing the possibility that the coronavirus might be spread?
Yeah, it's a great question, and of course, it though it's been said before, it bears repeating that safety of our players, our staff, everyone has to be of the utmost priority, and it is, and it will continue to be. The reason, and this is through consultation and a huge thanks, our kit partner and our first partner and largest partner is UC Davis Health, which obviously is a world-leading expert, and we are in touch with their epidemiology experts among county health and state health and league officials as well, that we are consulting on every topic. I've become maybe a pseudo expert, but I still have a long way to go. But from the conversations every single day, Right. Certainly the fact that it's outside is helpful. Certainly the fact that the way soccer is played is, you know, across a large field, mostly distanced from each other. For our first couple months back in training, actually all of our training was socially distanced. Each player was by himself in his corner of the field. And when they're not on the field, they're in masks, locker room, everything else has changed. So putting all those protocols in place, amongst many others, of course, the behaviors outside of the field are essential and vital. The travel has been reduced. Everything has gone into making sure that we are keeping safety at the forefront. And it's been successful. It's imperfect. And we are humble about that and need to make sure that we stay on top of everything and know the possibilities. But that's why it's worked, and we're excited to continue going.
Hey, Ben, can you give us an update on the construction of the new stadium and the teams entering into MLS? Has any of that been postponed due to COVID-19?
Yeah, just a couple of weeks ago, we formally announced that our first year would be shifted from 2022 to 2023. So it has been pushed back a year. A lot of that is around stadium construction and the impacts of COVID, you know, both directly to putting the staffing plan together, to various supplies, to even the financial markets surrounding and how to get this done. So a lot of impacts here. And as time went on, and this is in consultation with, of course, our ownership alongside the commissioner, Board of Governors at MLS, and actually the other teams, the other expansion teams, all pushed back a year. Mm-hmm. And oversimplifying something that clearly is complex is we only have one opportunity, I'll say from my seat as Sacramento Republic, to launch this world-class stadium and to launch this team for the first time ever, you know, a stadium that will last for 30 years, a franchise that we hope will be here for, you know, 100 years, many, many generations. We only get one chance to do it. And given all the impacts, let's make sure that we're taking the time, that we're not sacrificing anything towards those goals, doing it the right way, making sure that it's a club that works for everybody, that it promotes jobs, economy, and probably most importantly, the character of Sacramento in the right way.
And definitely
let's
the rail
take the
yards
time
area
to do it the right way.
Mm-hmm. Ben, I saw that you were on the Zoom call while we were talking with the CIF just a moment ago, and I understand that Sac Republic FC players have used some of the time when they weren't playing to connect with students in high school. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is one of a number of ideas that came through in these past few months from our staff and just from talking to others in the community, talking to the head of school districts, talking to teachers. I have kids of my own, and I saw the, you know, the distance learning and the Zoom classes that were going on, and sometimes the monotony that happened. And to add some energy, you know, certainly to the kids, but also to the teachers. You know, we had this idea of, hey, like, what if we just had players that zoomed in on these as a surprise to a class meeting that was going on for 30 minutes? They could talk about their job. The kids could ask them questions. And it started with two classes, and it turned into, I think, we over 2,000 students just over a short amount of time. We had every single player, every single coach involved that would come in. They would do their distance training, and then they would come in and do Zoom calls with kids, kindergarten, first grade. The questions were hilarious.
I bet, right?
That coming from all, but it really provided a great boost of energy for them. Like I said, for the teachers. Seeing it firsthand as a parent, certainly necessary. So again, that's something that we're continuing to look at phase two of that as we go into the fall,
Okay.
knowing that schools will still be in some distance learning protocols of some sort. Among the many programs we're doing, we're going to find ways that make sure that we're doing our part in the community.
Yeah, it also
that's
helps
a responsibility we take seriously.
It also helps keep that spark for soccer going for the kids of today. You know, it seems to be one of the sports of choice for sure. And when everything gets put on hold like this, there's, you know, concern that could wane. But, you know, little acts like that also help. Sac Republic FC president. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Ben.
Yeah, I was saying absolutely, right? I mean, we know that it's, I mean, school, every aspect of all of our lives have been impacted, and schools, and also soccer. We know that rec soccer leagues have gone through a lot. Some are postponing their season entirely, and we know it's important. I think, you know, your previous guest was talking about it's sports, it's beyond just the game right. itself, right? It's the teachings of discipline and teamwork, and those it's tough to take a hiatus on. And if we can provide some small notion where we're helping kids and parents and communities do that, we absolutely think it's valuable, and we'll continue to step forward.
Well, best of luck as the season progresses. We really hope the best for the team, and also just that everyone stays healthy and safe, and you know, that you're able to pull this off.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's a big undertaking. I think you mentioned it, Randall, before. You know, sports to bring the community together, right? That's what one thing sports does as much as any. And to do that, we're going to do our part. So thank you very much.
Excellent. Sac Republic FC president and COO, Ben Gumpert. Ben, thanks so much.
Much appreciated. Go Republic.
All right. And now to the Sacramento Kings. Just briefly here, the team has been down in the Orlando, Florida bubble. It's a part of the NBA restart. Greg Wissinger is the managing editor for KingsHerald.com, and he's been covering the latest on the NBA restart and how the Kings are doing. And he joins us now from Germany, I believe. Welcome to Insight, Greg.
Thanks for having me. I'm actually in Colorado. My Twitter bio is not correct on that.
Oh. Okay, well, you sound good either way. For those who don't know, give us a snapshot of the Orlando bubble and how the NBA restart came together.
Yeah, so what the NBA decided to do was to restart the season without necessarily all the teams. So 22 of the 30 NBA teams are down in Orlando at the facilities at Disney World, where they have, you know, obviously enough hotel space, and they've got conference rooms that are big enough that they've turned those into practice arenas, and then they have actual arenas for games. The remaining 22 teams will play 8 games apiece. At the end of that, that'll determine playoff seeding, and you know, as teams begin to be eliminated, they'll start to head home. Mm-hmm. So they've kind of sequestered everyone to where they can do daily testing and try to make sure that there's no outside exposure to, you know, COVID-19 or anything else that's going on.
Yeah. Greg, how are the Kings managing?
Not so hot. So they got blown out for the second time last night. So both games that they've played, the initial scrimmages, but both games they played so far, they gave up really big first quarter leads and never came back. And so Kings fans are not too happy today.
All right, Greg, we're going to leave it there. There's a little bit of audio trouble, but I think you got the main points across. Greg Wissinger, managing editor for KingsHerald.com. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Still ahead, we'll look into the economics of sports and how the efforts to control spread of the coronavirus are playing out there. Plus, we touched on it a little bit just a moment ago, but how sports help young minds learn to socialize, among other aspects of emotional development. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. The COVID-19 pandemic is clearly causing major damage to just about every sector of the economy, and that includes sports. Sacramento's Golden One Center was built, as we know, with hopes to revitalize the city's downtown, turning it from a Monday through Friday government center to a 7-day-a-week destination. And to some degree, that was coming to fruition. But There have been no Kings games for months at the arena, nor did the Rivercats take to the field for fans this season at the newly named Sutter Health Park in West Sac. It's not just ticket sales that get hit by this. There are so many supporting companies and surrounding businesses that also depend on the flow of fans. And that's just one aspect of how sports play into the region's economy. Victor Matheson is an economist at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and joins us now to help us wrap our minds around this. Victor, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Worcester, did I get it right?
I'm very impressed anytime people get it right. So well done.
Should I drop the R a little more? Worcester?
If you really want to be an East Coaster, it has to be Worcester.
Okay.
But Worcester is fine. It just anytime we don't hear Worcester, we're pretty happy.
Right. Well, Victor, at any rate, we think of sports as fun, leisure, a pastime, but really it's big business.
Yeah, so that's right. And it's a business that's been hurt more than any other sector in the economy overall. If we look, for example, at employment numbers, that first full month we were out there in April and May, we lost about 45% of all jobs in the leisure and hospitality sector. That includes hotels, it includes restaurants, it includes arts and entertainment. And again, in the specific arts and entertainment sector, again, mm-hmm. about 45% of all jobs vanished in the United States in that sector in April and May. And of course, that's because no one is going to live games anymore.
Right.
The number of Americans who watched a live sporting event, at the college or professional level was about 10 million people last April. And of course, this April, it was about zero people. So obviously that's a huge impact on the leagues themselves, as well as all of that, all of the other people who are supporting that as well. And of course, I'm not even talking about the participatory sports, the youth clubs and all that, which I think our next guest is going to talk about.
Yeah. So yesterday during CNN's State of the Union, White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx reiterated that every state's response to COVID-19 will be different through reopenings. Here's that clip.
We are in a new phase, and that's why I really wanted to make it clear to the American people. It's why we started putting out governor reports directly to the health officials and the governors in every single state, because we could see that each thing had to be tailored. So each state has a tailored set of recommendations based on what we're seeing at the community level, what we're seeing relevant to the hospitals, and each of these responses have to be dramatically tailored.
So, Victor, these varied state responses to COVID-19 and reopenings impact sports and teams bouncing back economically. What do you make of having a patchwork like that in when it comes to the economics of sports?
So let me be clear. I'm not that kind of doctor, right? But in any sort of league where we've got interstate travel between leagues, it doesn't matter if Boston has its act together, and it looks like Massachusetts is looking pretty well nationwide. But if Boston has to go to Philadelphia to play, where Pennsylvania is one of the latest victims here of skyrocketing numbers, if the Red Sox have to go play the Marlins, of course, I'm picking two teams that have been on hiatus for the last week because of COVID-19 cases.
Right.
In the sort of sport where we have that, you're not going to be able to play. And New England, again, the area with the lowest rates of coronavirus spread, at least in the current data, they were the places that actually canceled all fall athletics at colleges and universities before anyone else. The Ivy Leagues first, some of the top small colleges all canceled. My own league, the Patriot League, was the second major Division I league to shut down. So, we're not playing in bubbles, and certainly in college, we're not playing in bubbles, and that's going to keep people from really engaging in any real sort of sports. It looks like the NBA. So, the Kings are going to be able to pull this off, it looks like, playing in a bubble. The NHL is coming up. Major League Soccer, obviously, which Sacramento is looking forward to, although looking forward to a year later than they
right.
thought.
We just learned, getting pushed back.
But they pulled off a successful tournament once they got that first wave. The National Women's Soccer League and WNBA have been able to play, but it looks very unlikely for college sports again, because you just can't bubble players in the way that the NBA with lots of salary and lots of resources.
Yeah. Victor, the examples that I pointed to leading into our conversation are easy to see. You know, when you shut down Golden One, downtown Sacramento is going to suffer. But what are some of the economic aspects of sports that we don't always think about?
So I think one of the ones to really think about is obviously what the NBA is looking to do here, for example, is looking to keep its TV people, its TV contracts in line. It's looking to keep its sponsorship in line. And the NBA thinks that it can retain about 60% of its total revenue by going to a bubbled TV-only model. Of course, that means that everyone involved in in-person play is still out of luck here, right? So again, think about ticket takers, think about the ushers, think about the people who do concessions, think about parking attendants, security. And unfortunately, of course, those are exactly the people who are working minimum wage jobs right in the first place. Probably not folks that have significant amounts of savings available to bring them through these times. These are jobs without particular benefits often as well. So, you have people without jobs, without health care. LeBron James is not having a great year this year. Who's a good Sacramento player. Darren Fox is not having a great year this year. But again, they are much better able to weather that blow than folks who really were earning minimum wage in the first place. And there is literally no time on the horizon where anyone with any certainty can say, yes, we're going to be back in packed stadiums and arenas watching the NBA, watching Major League Soccer.
Mm-hmm. Victor Matheson, he's an economist at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Victor, thank you so much for your insight into this.
Of course, my pleasure to be here.
Finally, this morning, we want to leave you with how sports play a vital role in our emotional development and sometimes become our career aspirations as well. Kelly Kratz is the national lead trainer for the Positive Coaching Alliance based in Silicon Valley, Mountain View. Kelly, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Randall. I'm actually from Philadelphia, but my company is based in the West Coast.
Yeah, so you heard the Philly shout out just now.
I did.
Yeah.
Not the best news from Philly, but yes.
Right. I hope you're doing well, you and your family and everyone that you work with. Kelly, let's talk a little bit about this aspect to sports and how students, their minds are developing at this point, and sports play a huge role in that.
They do. And I think, for such an unprecedented time, I have been more than impressed at how the student athletes have been pushing through. We talk a lot about Positive Coaching Alliance, about how we train athletes for life. We're really teaching them, sports is teaching them the life lessons that they need to succeed in life. And there's no better time than right now for them to push through and kind of rely on these life lessons. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest emotional piece has been just missing the sport, missing their friends, missing the relationship part. As I said, I've been so impressed. I've been coaching. I coach high school. I've been coaching for about 25 years. And with PCA, we've been doing lots of workshops for coaches because they want to keep their teams involved. They want to keep them connected. They're working on a lot of mental skills training and bringing the teams together. But we've also been doing a lot of, Facebook Live posts to parents saying, how can you keep your kids? How can you set up a sport in the backyard? Kids want to play. And when you tell them they can't be with their team, a lot of times it really stresses them out. So I've been joking with more kids about going to the 80s model. Right. Go outside and play.
That's what I grew up with. So Kelly, what are you telling parents? What is a takeaway tip for any parent that's listening right now in terms of keeping their kids excited about this sport that they really can't play at the level that they were?
It's the same message that we also send to coaches and we send to athletes, is we call it the mastery approach. Focus on what you can control. You can't control that your children's basketball league is not working or football might not be happening. What you can control is in your area, what you have access to. So whether that's, they can't play soccer, but they can strap on a backpack and go for a hike. The good news is that most athletes can do something, even if it's in your home, even if you don't have access to fields and basketball hoops, there's something in your house or in your yard you can do that's physical. And so we've just been encouraging parents to not put your kids in a box. We've been doing this even pre-pandemic. Your child is not a basketball player. They're a really awesome 10-year-old kid that loves to play basketball. Maybe during a pandemic, they become a runner, or they become fantastic at ping pong, or now they're a yoga master, or now they just started lifting weights. So just keeping an open mind with parents and having them just sort of reframe. And it's a great opportunity for parents to really value their child's other skills, their creativity, their music ability, things like that, that they haven't been really focused on because we've been at the sidelines of the sports for so long.
Kelly, that's such a great point. We were talking earlier here in the show about how some sports may be elevated during this period, sports that don't have as much contact. And there are likely kids out there who went with whatever the sport of the day was because that was the popular sport, who might find, wow, I really like swimming, or I really like whatever it is, and just completely excel there, and may have never had the opportunity to go down that road had it not been for the situation we find ourselves in.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of places around the country that tennis courts are still open, and, you know, you can social distance. There's a lot of sports you can do with social distancing. And I think just having parents be creative and coaches have creative ways of getting teams together. I mean, we've seen teams coming together and they're literally playing rugby 6 feet apart. They're not doing the tackle. They're doing the skills and the tossing, and they're wiping off balls, but they're finding creative ways to do it. And I saw a dance studio this morning as I passed by. They were running. They were out running. They were all in their dance leotards. Uh-huh. And I thought, they can do it together. It's music. Let them do it.
Kelly, give us some insight into the Positive Coaching Alliance. How did it come to be, and what's the goal? What is it that you're trying to do?
The simple goal is to develop better athletes and better people, more importantly. Positive Coaching Alliance was birthed out of Stanford University in 1998 by a gentleman named Jim Thompson. And he just saw that kids weren't enjoying sports like they used to. And they were in droves. And he said, there's something going on here because sports gave us so much and gave him so much. So he actually started it as sort of a small movement to train coaches in the Bay Area. And it just exploded like wildfire. So we've been training coaches since 1998, parents and athletes as well. We do partnerships with youth sports organizations, colleges, high schools, and they are continuing full bore during this pandemic. So it's been using a lot of sports psychology, a lot of great practices. We have a national advisory board of over 200 world-renowned athletes, athletes and coaches, and they share their vision with us, and they share the vision that they want for their own kids. It's really cool when you have somebody like Summer Sanders or Julie Foudy or Bruce Bochy who get to tell us like, hey, we want this for our kids because this is what sports should be. And that's I think one of the nice things that have come out of this pandemic is that people have slowed down and parents have gotten to play backyard ball and had fun with their kids and not always zipping them and zooming them to hotels. And that right. big business sports has halted. So, you know, kids are going to play what they want to play. And it's been a great way to bring families together in sport.
Kelly, any coach at any school can become part of the Positive Coaching Alliance?
Absolutely. I mean, we have partnerships with any schools. You can go on our website. We're always looking for, you know, great coaches that want to do what I do and deliver messages all over the country. But we also have partnerships. So we have different levels of partnerships. Sometimes a school district will say, hey, you know, we would love to just have you come out and just train some of our coaches and sort of the mental skills. A lot of times coaching involves like, here's a bag of balls and here's a whistle, you're the coach. So we do a lot of coach training. We have principles. We have three major principles of mastery is the one, filling the emotional tank is the other one, and honoring the game. And they're the three principles that go throughout every workshop that we do. Parents, coaches, athletes, leadership. We've actually just started doing a lot more of positive motivation in the workplace.
I bet.
We're at positive motivation, so we've been bringing it into corporations. And especially on Zoom during the pandemic, that's been getting a lot of great responses because morale's down.
Right.
And they thought a company that knows how to positively motivate people.
Kelly, we don't have much time left, and I want to address those students who might have been looking at sports as a possible avenue to get out of poverty, that they saw this as, you know, I really excel at this and this, and if I really put my mind to it, then this is a way for me to really be a sports superstar. What would you tell those kids right now who just all of a sudden their avenue got a big, you know, roadblock sign?
Yeah, I would say don't stop. Don't stop. I mean, most of the athletes that are, I know I have a daughter that's a 2021 graduate. I mean, the recruiting is really funky right now, but if it's a young athlete, they're a great athlete. And I think the mental skills goes along with the talent. The more college coaches we talk to, they say they want the whole package. They don't just want the best, or the fastest runner. They want somebody that's, they want to see an athlete, student athlete that has resilience and has patience and persistence and mental toughness and empathy and all those character qualities that you can get from any sport.
All right.
So just keep.
Thank you, Kelly. Kelly Kratz, National Lead Trainer for the Positive Coaching Alliance. It's based in Mountain View, but she's in Philadelphia today. Hey, thank you, Kelly.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White. A big thank you to producer Kyle McKinnon, who put this show together. We'll see you tomorrow. So that's...
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's deep dive look into one single topic from several different perspectives. Now for an in-depth conversation regarding the news of the day. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. A good Monday morning to you. I'm your host, Randall White. Today, we look at how COVID-19 is upsetting a part of our culture that is instrumental in how we build relationships, stay fit, and spend our leisure time from elementary school all the way up through college and beyond. We're talking about sports. On the pro side of the issue, leagues are doing what they can to cobble together something that resembles a season. We'll speak with the head of the Sacramento Republic FC on how the area's main soccer team is handling it all. Plus, these changes have major economic ramifications for cities like Sacramento, with events canceled at Golden One and Sutter Health Park. And there is the mental toll as well, especially for high school students who use sports to develop emotional skills and, in some cases, as an avenue to get out of poverty. But first up this morning, we're getting a much-needed update on the politics of COVID-19. Over the weekend, it was reported that California tragically saw a record number of deaths from the disease caused by the coronavirus. For more on that and what's happening on Capitol Hill, we turn to one of our favorite go-to journalists in Washington, D.C. Kate Irby is McClatchy's California congressional reporter, and she joins us now. Hi, Kate.
Hey, Randall. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's start with the latest numbers for California, including the 219 deaths we learned about on Saturday, which broke the previous single-day tally, which I believe was set on the previous Tuesday.
Yeah, so even though California has seen rates of actual coronavirus infections not increasing as heavily as they were, our deaths are still coming at record rates. So, and hospitalizations are even down, but still we have a record number of deaths. So this is definitely not over in California. We've definitely hit second surge point, and it's very important for people to follow health recommendations and for some stimulus money and some economic money to be coming to the state.
Yeah. And on that point, you know, people are being encouraged, beyond encouraged, to stay home, to not mix, to do what they can. And a lot of that, you know, has created a tough economy for a job, a lot of people out of work. What is the latest on the stimulus plan?
So obviously, Republicans and Democrats have very different ideas of what is needed. Right now, it seems like they've started having more productive talks over the weekend. Both sides have said they now know where the other one stands and where they agree and where they don't agree. The problems are obviously they disagree on a lot, not even just the amounts, but what actually needs funding. So Democrats want more for SNAP benefits, also known as food stamps. Money for food banks. Republicans say that's not needed at all. More funding for USPS and postal workers is a huge disagreement. And there's just a lot in here. And the unemployment benefits, obviously, Democrats want $600 in increased funding per week to continue. And Republicans want that phase down to $200. And it's a lot of space between them right now.
Mm. And you mentioned the Postal Service. I mean, that really comes into play with the upcoming election.
Yes. So it sounds like Republicans are willing to maybe give some money to the Postal Service, but they don't like that money being connected to elections right now, which Democrats are really pushing. So obviously things can look very different. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with how these negotiations typically go, but all it takes is one meeting. So, you know, they go in really far apart and then all of a sudden there's one really productive meeting and then they come out with something that looks totally different from what we've been talking about. So just, you guys got to follow these updates. And
that's fascinating, Kate. I didn't realize that. So, you know, going into Monday morning, things look really far apart. Yeah, there were some, you know, productive meetings, as you mentioned, over the weekend. But there could be a meeting going on right now as we speak, and all of a sudden everything's changed and there's a deal.
Yeah, I mean, all it takes is one meeting where all of a sudden they're like, okay, we figured out what we need to do and we need to hammer out the exact details. But it can turn really quickly. And Mark Meadows, President Trump's chief of staff, has said that he's going to Pelosi's office every single day until they have a deal. So it could change quickly, but right now they are very far apart.
Yeah, you mentioned Mark Meadows, but President Trump does not appear to be playing a major role in these negotiations. I saw a report that he actually left town and went golfing this weekend. What are people saying about that? That he's not that connected to what's happening with this stimulus money?
You know, so there's a mix. There's some people who really criticize President Trump, especially for the golf trips when this kind of thing is going on. You know, people are dying, that kind of thing. But the issue is, of course, that he usually has his surrogates do it. And that's not abnormal for a president either to have surrogates do it. In this case, it's probably more productive because Mark Meadows and Mnuchin have a record of working with Speaker Pelosi and working with Democrats. And we know Speaker Pelosi and President Trump do not get along. And those talks between those two probably would not be as productive. So Mark Meadows is saying that he keeps updating Trump all the time, that he calls him after every single meeting, so he's up to date. But Trump taking kind of a backseat to this might make these talks more productive.
So. Mm-hmm. So you're in Washington, D.C. We know that you have your ear to the ground. I'm wondering, former Vice President Joe Biden is expected to announce his running mate soon. And the shortlist does include some members of Congress from California. We've got Senator Kamala Harris, of course, and Congressional Black Caucus Chair Representative Karen Bass of the L.A. region. What are you hearing?
So there's a lot of mixed things, and it doesn't seem like there's a clear front runner right now. Everyone seemed to favor Senator Harris, and I think that's still kind of the conventional wisdom. But you still have people in the Biden camp kind of putting these things out on her saying, you know, we didn't like that she attacked us during the debate. She's not apologetic enough for that. She's not as loyal as Biden wants somebody to be. And they keep, you know, saying all of these different problems. So, but it's not clear how much that actually is a problem for her to actually.
Well, could those, when the Biden camp does that, could those be feelers to see, like, do they have traction? Or when we put that kind of stuff out there, does it just sort of fade off and it's not as big of a deal as maybe we're putting on it?
That definitely could be a tactic. So I'm not sure there. It's kind of speculation, but definitely that's a possibility. Karen Bass, obviously, too, as you said, has come up, and she kind of had this headwind after putting forward this police brutality bill that the House did. And she might have maybe the temperament that Biden is more looking for. He says he wants someone who is like how he was for Obama, someone who's very loyal, but is comfortable staying behind the scenes and backing him up. And maybe Karen Bass fits that more to him than Kamala Harris does. But it's unclear right now. Even the camps don't seem to know very much. They're really trying to see what Biden camp is thinking, and I don't think anyone has a really clear idea right now.
I saw that Florida Senator Marco Rubio attacked Karen Bass this morning, and it was making me wonder if maybe she's more of a front runner than we think when you start to see that
maybe.
Level.
Maybe. I don't think Marco Rubio has any insight into Biden camp, though.
No, of course, right? So, all right. McClatchy's California congressional reporter, Kate Irby, thank you so much for joining us this morning with that update from Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Randall.
Demonstrators with Black Lives Matter Sacramento marched this weekend to protest police brutality and racial inequality. But Portland is where the spotlight on these protests continues to shine. Los Angeles reporter Melissa Etahad is covering the unrest. Her latest piece was in the Times yesterday, Sunday, titled Portland, America's Whitest Big City, is an Unlikely Hub of Black Lives Matter. Melissa, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So I got to ask you, why Portland? Your piece does a pretty good job of laying this out, but I want you to explain that to those listening right now.
Right, right. So, you know, Portland has a tradition of social movements and activism. I mean, you look at 2003 with, you know, Iraq War, and then you have the 2011 Occupy Portland rallies, which were inspired by, you know, Occupy Wall Street movement. So it's a progressive city, but also it's a city that's majority white. And the reason why Portland is overwhelmingly white is that Black people were excluded from residing in Oregon well until the 20th century. So there's a long history of racism.
Melissa, I want you to repeat that, because that is such a major point that I think few people know. Why, again, is Portland overwhelmingly white?
So Black people were excluded from residing in Oregon well into the 20th century. So that's one reason why you have such an overwhelmingly, you know, population that is white. I would say like over 70% of the population in Oregon is white. And in Portland in particular, it's 77%. So it's a situation where, you know, right now you have, you know, Black people and Black activists coming out to, you know, the federal courthouse in downtown Portland, and there's, you know, subtle hints of racism that still exists even within the protest movement. Mm.
So within the generations of some of our parents, grandparents, great grandparents, it was not legal for Black people to move to Oregon and live there. That's just shocking.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, you know, you fast forward to more recent times, and you have gentrification, urban mm-hmm. renewal, and other factors that have dispersed the Black population. So a population that was already small to begin with now, you know, has been lacking in resources when it comes to education, you know, health inequities, those factors still kind of exist in Portland and in Oregon in general. So you amplify all that with what's been happening this year with, you know, the Black Lives Matter protest movement. And you have a situation where this is kind of Portland's moment, and Black community has been getting together, and you have white allies who are coming down and, you know, was started as a protest movement to kind of demand change. And those changes included defunding the police by more than 50%, and trying to kind of allocate resources from the city's budget to, you know, things that would help the Black community, kind of morphed into this larger issue when in early July, when President Trump deployed those federal agents to protect the courthouse. And the number of protesters were dwindling in early July. But then it kind of revamped after, you know, excessive use of force by the federal agents.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. If reports that, you know, after President Trump sent in the federal officers, it sort of reignited the fervor of the demonstrations. And then when those officers were pulled last week, I believe the protests calmed down somewhat again. And that matches with your reporting.
Yeah, absolutely. It was pretty tense, I would say, the week before that Trump kind of agreed to withdraw, or have a phased withdrawal, I should say, of the federal agents. The night before that was supposed to take place, you know, federal agents had come out from the courthouse and were shooting rubber bullets, lots of tear gas again at protesters who were, you know, sparking flames and setting off fireworks, throwing you know, bottles at the federal agents. One thing that has been kind of interesting to note was that, you know, when the federal agents were there, sometimes they would go far beyond the perimeter of the courthouse. They would go blocks trying to disperse protesters. So that kind of raises issues of whether that's constitutional and unlawful. So it was getting pretty tense. And the fact that, you know, you have Oregon Governor Kate Brown calling what was happening in terms of what the federal agents doing as like an occupying force and calling for a ceasefire. Now, those are very loaded terms, right? You don't see that often.
Right.
So it kind of really shows you the magnitude of what was happening on the ground and how at least now we have a de-escalation of the issues.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. LA Times reporter Melissa Etta-Hodd. You can find her story at latimes.com, of course, and it's titled Portland, America's Whitest Big City in an Unlikely Hub, is an Unlikely Hub of Black Lives Matter. Melissa, thank you so much for making time on this Monday.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right. Up next, high school sports are a big part of the culture in Northern California. And this year, coronavirus prevention efforts have much of that activity on hold, at least for now. We'll get an update on what we can expect as we move into the fall. And there's been a lot of attention on the Sac Republic FC after the franchise won the rights to become part of Major League Soccer. And announced plans for a new stadium, right? Where does all that stand? We'll speak with the club's president in just a moment. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.